About 60 million Americans, a striking 20% of our population, live in rural areas across the United States, and they struggle with long-standing and even worsening health-related challenges. Significant government programs have been deployed at the local and federal levels, but rural health challenges persist for these populations. What will it take to deliver the care needed to advance and maintain better health in rural communities? The first step in improving rural health outcomes is deepening our understanding of the distinct context of rural communities. We need unfiltered, firsthand accounts from those on the ground working to provide and support quality healthcare while navigating the complex maze of financial uncertainties, dire workforce shortages, and inconsistent access to care. In this conversation, real-world experiences and data-driven insights provide a powerful lens through which to examine the healthcare realities of rural communities, their impact on individuals, and the most effective ways to begin tackling the obstacles to accessible and effective healthcare. I'm Dr. Erica Rogan, a director in Federal Healthcare Advisory at KPMG and host of this edition of Framing Health's Future, an initiative from the federal health leaders at KPMG. I'm delighted to have with me today three leaders who are advancing rural health equity. Dr. Alana Knudsen, Director of the Norc Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis. Dr. Trish Milner, Staff Physician in Family Medicine and Surgical Obstetrics at Mahaska Health in Oskaloosa, Iowa, and Associate Professor at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And Dr. David Schreiner, author, coach, and president and CEO of Catherine Shaw Bethia Hospital in Dixon, Illinois. Thank you all for joining me today. I'm looking forward to an enlightening and productive conversation. For those of us who don't live in rural areas, it can be difficult to really conceptualize the diversity of rural communities. So I'd like to paint a picture of some of the realities of rural health for our listeners. So I'd love for each of you to describe a health issue or trend that you think is most concerning for your own community. And Dr. Milner, I'd like to start with you. What's something that really concerns you for your community?
So I think the common thing in America is obstetrical care. And we know that maternal morbidity and mortality in America is dismal compared to other developed nations. And it's even worse in rural areas. So we have women that are traveling an hour and a half just to have a 15-minute appointment, and it really shouldn't be that way. The access of care is limited and then increases risks of hemorrhage and preterm delivery, poor prenatal outcomes. And also with that, I think hand-in-hand is the psych deserts that we have in rural areas. And even more so plays into the obstetrical care because there's a lot of postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. I mean, even postpartum suicide and infanticide, we see more commonly in rural areas, and it's becoming more prevalent. So I think that those two issues not only plague America, but they significantly plague the rural areas, especially in Southeast Iowa.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot to take on and to really think about and the role that you're playing in your community to try to address that issue. So I'm sure your community is really, really grateful to have you, Dr. Milner. Dr. Schreiner, I'd like to hear from you about a challenge that you're facing in your community, particularly from the lens of a hospital leader.
Thank you, Erica. I completely agree with Dr. Milner in the OB services as well as behavioral health are such important factors in our area. The other one that I would add is transportation challenges. You mentioned, Erica, not everyone lives in rural settings, and we don't have an L. We don't have public transportation in rural areas. And we serve two counties at Catherine Shaw Bethia Hospital. So the geographic distance can be a challenge to get our patients to appointments, to get them to necessary procedures. And also just the coordination so that if the patient does need to come into one of our facilities, they don't have to come back multiple days. We can take on those challenges of trying to coordinate those visits to make it easier for them.
How does your staff identify those transportation needs for patients?
Yeah, one of the beautiful things in rural areas is we know our patients so well. Mm. And so many times we can be very creative. And they may not even be formal social service agencies that help, but they can be friends, they can be neighbors, they can be people at the same churches, or their kids go to the same schools. So a lot of times it's not as formal as one might think, but it's bringing our communities together, you know, we can serve patients in need.
Yeah, what an opportunity in rural areas to have that personal connection and really be able to utilize it for patient outcomes and for patient access. So that's really great to hear. Dr. Knudsen, I'd like to turn to you. You've done so much research and work. I know you come from a rural area. What is something that's concerning for you?
I agree wholeheartedly with my colleagues. The issues that they identified are foundational to health and well-being in rural communities. But I also look at the end game. What happens with mortality? And if you look across the 10 leading causes of death, rural residents are higher across 9 of them. The only one that is not higher for rural is homicide. And then when you add race and ethnicity, you see even more so the dual disparity of place and race ethnicity that really is creating tremendous disparities in our rural communities. There was a recent study conducted by my colleagues at USDA looking at mortality from the lens of chronic diseases and looking at the mortality for people 25 to 54. And there was a 43% difference between rural residents' mortality of things from congestive heart failure, respiratory, endocrinology, diabetes, and the like, as compared to their urban counterparts. So we need to address those issues that we just heard were really underlying some of the challenges that our rural communities are facing, to be able to look at how we can extend quality of life and make sure that our rural residents are able to lead healthy, productive lives.
Absolutely. And from what I've heard from all of you, it's really the challenges are across the board. We hear of acute care issues, social determinants of health issues, as well as chronic illness issues and outcomes. And your point, Dr. Knudsen, about kind of the compounding nature of being in rural areas on top of other disparities that folks might be experiencing is also, I think, you know, really striking. And there's so much to address for rural areas. Well, with that, we know that rural areas are susceptible to many of the same issues that we see on a national scale, but we also need to tackle those localized challenges in rural areas too. And so, for example, in recent years, we've seen certainly a worsening workforce shortage issue in rural communities, which can affect both access and quality. So, Dr. Schreiner, as a hospital leader, how have you seen workforce shortages impact rural communities?
It's dramatically different, Erica, than it was earlier in my career. And some of that, I think, is the availability, and very much so with specialty care. The idea of having a practitioner, a provider come in 1 or 2 days a week sounds fantastic. But what our experience has been is that when someone joins a larger system, when they're first recruited to that larger system, they're willing to come out into a rural area and practice. But understandably, as their practice fills at home, it's a little bit harder to find those days to get away. And so we mentioned endocrinology, for example, for diabetics that can begin care with a provider and they have a great 3 or 4 months of sessions, but then that provider leaves and they're starting all over. That's a difficult challenge from so many perspectives. Mm-hmm. So it's really that idea of nationwide, we don't have as many specialists as we have had in the past. And I think that that can be magnified in a rural setting.
Absolutely. And how do you see that affecting care coordination as well?
Oh, it's such a big way, because our family medicine physicians take on so much more than they ever have in the past. Mm-hmm. And they certainly sometimes have consultation, but it may not be as formal as what they would like it to be. It could be more of a phone call and an explanation saying, this is what I have going on. What do you think? As opposed to that laying out of hands and the formal referral that would happen in the past.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Milner, as a clinician, you're certainly uniquely attuned to healthcare workforce issues, and even more so as a maternity care provider. And we know that over half now of rural hospitals no longer provide obstetric care. And you mentioned just how important having access to that care is for maternal health outcomes. Can you tell us how workforce issues impact the day-to-day patient care that you are involved in, and particularly for pregnant people and other special populations?
It's a very deep, deep question. That in and of itself could be a whole discussion. But I think the biggest thing, having did all my training and career in the military, mm-hmm. and then moving to a rural area, and I've been here for 3 years, it's really eye-opening on the limitations that we have, because of really what it comes down to is money. We can't convince OBGYNs and MFMs to come here because the reimbursement for OB in general is really low. And so the incentive to come to a rural area versus an urban area where you have more resources and you don't have to do as much as, for instance, as a family OB doctor, I could do a C-section in the morning, a circumcision, see a full day of clinic, do a bunch of procedures, ultrasounds, and then run a code all within the same day. In a tertiary center, you don't have those issues because you have all the specialists there. So really what it comes down to is making it an incentive for physicians, PAs, NPs to come to rural areas that are highly trained and willing to take on more than probably they should. The way you do that, I think, is increasing residency spots for physicians, because at the end of the day, everybody wants on their team the highest trained person to take care of them in an emergency setting. I believe everybody should have that right. And I definitely think nurse practitioners and PAs help bridge the gap in a lot of areas. But really what it comes down to is we need more physicians. You can't just keep putting a Band-Aid on and saying, here's, you know, see a nurse practitioner, see a PA. We need more physicians. And the funding for residency spots has went down over the years. And the funding for primary care, I mean, everyone should have a primary care doctor or provider. And if you don't, then you're not even getting standard of care. The physicians are reimbursed the least is the primary care doctors. The burnout rate is highest. Mm-hmm. And so then you add in the rural component, and then you're, why should we be here? And essentially, the turnover rate for rural physicians in primary care, and that's OBGYN, pediatricians, family medicine physicians, and ER physicians specifically, is very low. And we're seeing a lot of like suicide and burnout and just leaving the profession altogether, especially in rural areas. It only takes one poor outcome for somebody to, you know, kind of spiral. But in the area that we are, when we have limited resources and we're dealing with a very litigious society, especially in OB, where you have to practice defensive medicine, it's just so stressful. I mean, most days I go to sleep, am I doing the right thing? I think that in and of itself is making it more incentivized to come to rural areas bigger. And that only can happen at the federal level.
Absolutely. Certainly the COVID pandemic shines such a light on burnout for physicians and other frontline providers. Dr. Milner, are there any strategies that you've seen that you think could be promising to address the burnout issue, given that it's so much more, you know, felt so acutely in rural areas?
Yeah, I think, again, what it comes down to, having, you know, when I got my MBA, I learned from the healthcare aspect, from the business side, really what it comes down to is money from the hospital side and the, you know, the provider side. There's really no quick fix to that.
It sounds like there's such an opportunity, though, to support providers in rural areas, to give them, you know, the tools and resources if shortages do exist in those areas, to provide support for those that are there and to help keep them there, because that's part of the issue as well, is recruitment and also retention to those healthcare settings. So thank you for identifying that. I think that the burnout issue is one that can be overlooked. And so it's really important to raise. Well, in light of the uniqueness of rural health, sometimes there can be a disconnect between policies and what's happening on the ground, even when policies might be very well intended. Dr. Milner, are there any specific challenges that you think healthcare providers in rural areas experience that might get overlooked at the policy level?
So we actually met with the director of HHS for the state of Iowa, and we kind of sat down to talk about these things, because we have Southeast Iowa, we have University of Iowa, which is east of us, an hour and a half away. And then we have Des Moines, which is an hour and a half away. And so we're a critical access hospital. The policies for urban hospitals or tertiary centers don't take into account the geographical location and also the agricultural things that, you know, with farming and different specialties that aren't in urban areas that need to be taken into consideration. A critical access hospital federally is only allowed 25 beds, but our hospital in Mahaska Health Services, 16 counties, 8 of which have closed their labor and delivery services. So that gives us an catchment area of about 100,000, a little bit less than that. And so you're asking us to only have 25 beds, and that includes OB. So if we have 8 laboring women, that takes away from the 25 beds. And then, so we're holding people in the ER. We're turning away people in the ER that probably should be admitted, but they're not as bad as the other 19 people here. Or we're telling pregnant women, hey, come back when you're in full-blown labor. And I think that at the policy level, critical access hospitals should be allowed many more beds than just 25 without taking away that funding or that designation of critical access, because it's an oxymoron saying you want us to take care of all of these patients, but you can only do it with this amount of beds.
Right. And so, you know, in thinking about the smaller hospitals, there's this potential to miss out on the realities of healthcare provision and what it really takes to provide high quality care for your community. And these policies can have unintended consequences as well, even when they have the right intentions. And so, Dr. Schreiner, can you speak to any experiences where policies may not have had the intended effect or where those good intentions might have gone awry?
One thing that comes to mind, Erica, is when we talk about some of the punishment that has been discussed for hospitals related to cybersecurity. And you and I had the opportunity to serve together on the AHA Small and Rural Task Force. And I remember one of our critical access hospital CEOs saying, I finally reached the tipping point where I have more people in my IT department than I have nurses on the floor. Do you remember that comment?
Yes, absolutely.
It stuck with years. And I think about independent rural hospitals that don't have that system level of support to do some of the things that are required either at the federal or the state level or by regulatory agencies. And any dollars that we spend on regulation are taken away from what we're able to provide in the clinical side. So I think that's one piece that makes it very difficult. The other thing that comes to mind is when we think about critical access hospitals and the cost plus reimbursement that is there for those facilities, which is wonderful. Organizations like the place where I work, an 80-bed facility, we call those tweener hospitals. We're between the critical access and the academic and tertiary centers. And we don't have any of those advantages. So it's very difficult to raise capital to get to a positive or even a neutral net income.
Yeah, and what a good point about just, again, the diversity in rural areas. So we're seeing that some have smaller settings, some have larger settings, still facing some of the similar challenges around financing, around being able to have the resources to provide care to their patients. And so just I think a great reminder that when you've seen one rural area, you've seen one rural area and that there's not really a monolith here. Dr. Schreiner, I want to stick with you for a moment here. Given your role leading a hospital, we know that hospitals play such a key role as employers in rural areas. And so when we see this trend of rural hospital closures over recent years, we're now, I believe, about 150 have closed since 2010. It's concerning from both a health perspective and an economic one for those areas. I'm wondering if there's any areas for policy action or government programs that you think could be promising to try to stem the tide of hospital closures?
Yeah, it certainly comes back to reimbursement. Anything that we can do to try to help from the reimbursement perspective is helpful. I started my career as a radiologic technologist and x-ray tech, and the hospital where I served in Kansas, it's closed today. And many years after that hospital closed, you saw the community dwindle because industry that's looking in, businesses are looking to begin to come into the community. One of the things that they ask, along with education and faith, is what's the hospital situation like? And when the hospital's not there, then that's a competitive advantage. So we often see that our rural hospitals are either the first or second largest employer, as you mentioned. They participate in so many things from a leadership perspective in our communities, in leading like Chamber of Commerce and the United Way and Kiwanis and Rotary and all those types of things. And I think that the policy changes that need to happen are related to capital again. How do we reinvest in our facilities to make sure that the patients that we serve have state-of-the-art technology and the buildings that are conducive to healing?
It certainly sounds like there's such a need for providing that financial base for hospitals and healthcare settings alike. And that's a great segue because I want to move us to the federal government. And so the government has attempted a number of initiatives and programs to bolster rural health, but they can fall short of making an impact that's both meaningful and sustainable. And so, Dr. Knudsen, I'd like to hear from you in your experience of evaluating rural health programs and programs that touch rural areas. Where do you see gaps between what's offered by the government, such as new payment models or grant programs, and what's truly needed by rural areas?
Great question. I think there are many opportunities. You know, sometimes we forget there's a number of agencies in the federal government that touch rural communities. For example, USDA is our number one funder for rural capital. And so, you know, when you look at the different types of support that are out there. I think we have to look also beyond HHS and look at USDA and some of our other partners in the federal government. But specific to programs that are looking at delivery and payment changes, one of the things that we have observed, and we have done a number of evaluations on behalf of the federal government for many different parts of Health and Human Services, but one of the things that is foundational is having some money to help transform whatever is happening in that rural environment. And as you know, we've talked a great deal about the shift from volume to value. However, we really need upfront funding, particularly for our independent hospitals that may not have access to a system hospital or a system that is able to support, for example, electronic health record, IT offices, and the like. There is a great need for particularly independent hospitals in rural America to be able to have upfront funding before they ever begin any kind of a model, as well as some ongoing technical support. And one of the things that I think is really promising is that, for example, some of the innovation models that CMMI has funded, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, in the rural space, they are also complemented by other investments, for example, from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. And, you know, being able to look at not only threading together different types of federal funding to support the successful implementation and testing of different types of models, but also looking at that private sector. Because one of the greatest opportunities I think we have going forward is seeing how our private partners are supporting innovation. Because as was discussed, our rural hospitals are foundational. They're the anchor to our rural community. And not only from the business side, but also looking at the philanthropic side. How can philanthropy best support the ability of rural hospitals to transform and meet the ever-changing needs of the healthcare market?
So many players involved potentially, right? So you mentioned several different federal agencies, philanthropic organizations. Do you see opportunity for more coordination among those stakeholders in your work?
Absolutely. And in fact, one specific one that is being led by the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health is looking at how to leverage different funding from the federal government, funding from the Federal Reserve Banks, from community development corporations, as well as private sector partners to support our rural providers to be able to continue to deliver the high quality services that our rural residents depend. And I'll give you a great example. One of the organizations that I have worked with was having a very difficult time finding places for preceptors and for residents in training to be able to have a rural experience. And so they were able to partner with a philanthropy. They built their own townhouses. So that issue was taken off the table. They were able to look at meeting an unmet need in their community to best support the continual investment in having a workforce that is trained in rural America come back to work and serve the needs of rural America.
Wow. And that touches on what Dr. Milner was talking about of, you know, getting that exposure to rural areas for clinicians to get used to what it's like to live there and understand the context. And that's a really great example.
And the opportunities.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Seeing a lot, you know, mm-hmm. being able to see all kinds of different health issues and work with patients so individually. Yeah, lots of good things there.
Erica, can I share a really quick story that builds
Please.
On? I just love what you said about that. And we had a situation where we worked with the USDA to get a grant to modernize and improve our obstetrical rooms. And everything that you mentioned in your comments happened to us. We don't have a full-time grant writer. The foundation development person that we have also serves as my administrative assistant. And so our executive team took that on and we were successful in getting a grant. However, as you said, it wasn't prepaid. So we had to finish the project first and then submit the dollar. And there's a part of, there's one of our board members said that if we had the funds to do it, then we wouldn't have to apply for the grant. So I hope that an illustration of how difficult these things are. We don't have the team members and the depth in some of those areas that are so important to take advantage of government programs.
If I could piggyback on all of those things, being that, you know, I'm the director of GME at our institution, and we had the University of Iowa Family Medicine residency entire, like their administrative staff come out to our hospital just to see like, hey, this is what's going on. Having them come and see like, this is what we're doing. We're doing actually more as far as clinically than what they're doing at the U because they have the specialists there. And they were really blown away about the experience that their residents could get to the point where we're in the process of discussing a family medicine rural residency as an extension of the University of Iowa at our institution, which is huge in and of itself because we could offer the OBGYN residents a rural tract. We could offer the family medicine residents a rural tract and then build on that in Iowa or in America if we lay that foundation. And there's other tracks out there, but there's not in Iowa. And I think that, you know, everything that my colleagues were talking about, like the grant writing and the USDA, like people don't understand that farmers are at the basis of our food in America, but they are also sickest patients. They are our farmers are my sickest patients. When I have a farmer that comes in, they're usually in their mid-50s or 60s and they're very sick. And so I think emphasizing the patients that are in these rural areas, like these are our farmers. These are the people that have our food. These are the people that are in, you know, manure all day and they're sick and they don't have the access to care. And if you make it more personal, sometimes I feel like tugging at people's heartstrings and all is always helpful.
And if I could add one more piece to that, I think we have also seen that in order to be able to, for example, maintain a community health worker program, you have to demonstrate value. And there was a really great program funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy that funded the implementation of a community health worker, but it did not have enough funding to really be able to conduct a robust evaluation to look at what that cost benefit was. And so what was really amazing was that philanthropy partners came in and said, you know what, we will pay for that evaluation component and collect the data and support. Because again, a lot of our rural facilities, they don't have a research arm that is part of that. That is what's at an academic institution. And so what happened through that partnership with the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, providing the seed money to implement a program to test it, the philanthropy paid for the evaluation. And after the program concluded, they had enough quantitative evidence and also qualitative. A lot of people commented about how helpful it was to have a community health worker navigate and support them as they were moving through the health system. They were able to get reimbursement for that community health from third-party payers. So they were able to not only sustain that program, they were able to grow that program. And, you know, I think meeting patients where they are, as my colleagues were saying, is just fundamental to what we do. But oftentimes we have to demonstrate the financial value, especially to payers, to be able to have those types of services reimbursed.
What an important point about making the case for rural health and making the case with data as to the benefits of those programs that are felt so locally. So really, really great points across the board. And one thing that you raised, Dr. Knudsen, is around partnerships and working together with others in the communities. I'd love to hear from you all about a partnership that maybe has provided some benefit in your community, whether that be a social service organization or a philanthropic organization. But Dr. Milner, any partnerships come to mind for you that's really helped to provide access or quality of care?
Every state has a quality care collaborative for like obstetrical care. In the state of Iowa, it just merged with the neonatal side or pediatric side to be the Iowa Perinatal Quality Care Collaborative, the IPQCC. And so in that it just goes through all the obstetrical and neonatal emergencies that could occur. And they go hospital by hospital, training all the rural hospitals on how to do simulations. And I think partnering them at the state level was amazing, because when I came in, I was originally the OB director of the hospital and, you know, just built the program up to standard, right? Just basic things like quantitative blood loss, you know, we implemented that and, you know, saw not only an increase in postpartum hemorrhage because now we were, you know, counting it, but also everybody feeling more comfortable in delivering urgent care. And then showing data is always how, like you said, you get funding. Showing data that these implementations actually work, but most importantly, seeing that complications rates, which postpartum hemorrhage is the most common complication rate, are going down.
And Dr. Schreiner, any partnerships stand out for you?
I think two stand out for me, Erica. The first is with our county health departments, and I had the opportunity to serve on our county health board of directors for 20 years. And when I left, I made sure that someone from the hospital took my place on that board. We do so many things, particularly around women's health, that are really advantageous to our community. The other example that we have that I think is really fun is with our local YMCA. And when you think about our patients go through rehab, whether it's physical rehab or cardiac rehab, they end their tenure, so to speak, with the organization, but they still need work. We don't have a pool at our hospital, but they do at the Y. So we have what we call a partner in health agreement with the YMCA. We give them $25,000 every year, and they were able to put their Nautilus equipment on a program so that they could change it out and upgrade it every 3 years. And then our physicians can actually write prescriptions to the YMCA that allow our patients to go at no charge for a period of time after they complete the rehab here at the hospital. And I think those types of partnerships are really rural. They're American rural, and they're the kinds of things that happen because we're on the board of directors and the leader of the Y is in Rotary with us. And those friendships come together and result in advantageous situations for our patients.
Wow, what a creative way to think about getting what patients need, even when it's beyond the four walls of the healthcare setting. So what a great example of that. And to your point about making that happen through personal relationships and connections within the community. Dr. Knudsen, you talked about some successful things that you've seen in your research and your work in evaluation. I'd love to hear more about how you think those pockets of success can be scaled more broadly.
Well, one of the things is being able to amplify what they're doing. And as part of our work, we support the Rural Health Information Hub. Mm-hmm. And I am happy to share all these resources at the end of today's discussion. But we have developed 25 different toolkits on topics such as social determinants of health, such as transportation, such as how do you address health equity in your rural communities. And these toolkits specifically identify rural success stories. And what's really great about each one of these toolkits is created in a modular fashion. So you can just plug and play where you need. If you're looking at an introduction, what does it mean to have a community health worker program? Or what are some examples? We have a clearinghouse of examples. And for those of us, I grew up in rural frontier North Dakota. I know the importance of connecting to people. And so our clearinghouse has examples of the program and also contact information. So rural people can connect with rural people who have successfully implemented. And I think that's one way of really scaling and having an opportunity to move programs outside. But one of the things that we have learned in our work is that a lot of our rural colleagues are doing amazing work, but they do not have the time to disseminate it. And they do not have the time or the staff to put it in peer-reviewed journals or even present at national conferences. So what we really try to do in our work is to identify those success stories and be able to bring them to a broader arena through RHI Hub, through different pieces of work that we do. And let me just give you one really great example through one of our evaluation programs that we conducted. We looked at the Healthcare Collaborative of Rural Missouri. And this is a group that started with the Public Health Department director, bringing together people to address a gap in services for the older adults in this rural Missouri community. And as they were talking, they identified a whole host of gaps the people around the table identified. And they realized that it went far beyond the issues that they thought they came to identify looking solely at older adults. And this Healthcare Collaborative of Rural Missouri in the last 15 years has now evolved to over 60 partners involved in this organization. There is also a federally qualified health center with a number of different satellites that serve people. But what's really interesting is that they are meeting the health-related social needs of the people in that community through having different touch points. They have a warehouse, they have food pantries, they even have some educational and training opportunities to help people connect with the business sector to help support people in securing employment. So I think, you know, to my colleague's comments, what our rural healthcare providers really do and what a critical role is really that convener and that important partner that really helps to connect the dots to be able to support the viability of that community, not just the health of the patients that are served, but the viability and the economics of that community.
It's such a holistic view of what community needs look like and finding the right partners to make that beneficial, you know, for those areas and to really tap into those needs.
Them at the table. That is yes. The challenge. Keeping people at the table because, as Dr. Milner said, there are people that change roles. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you have people changing roles, you need to make sure you have people that are being groomed for their role as leaders. And that's what we really need to focus on in many of our rural communities, building our leaders of the future.
Right. And that helps to make those relationships sustainable and not one-off kind of partnerships exactly. That don't maintain the benefits that they have. I want to continue with this theme of thinking outside of healthcare provision alone, because we know that a lot of the issues that you have all raised are highlighting the deeply interconnected challenges that we have with health and other aspects of things like broadband access, transportation, which was mentioned, housing insecurity, and other types of social determinants. So Dr. Milner, in your practice, how do you see this kind of interconnectedness playing out when serving your patients?
So we do a lot of telehealth, and telehealth is big, especially in rural areas, not just for the patients, but also for us when we're dealing with situations where we need to consult a specialist, but they're not readily available. So having that connection with our tertiary centers and that openness to take a consult via telephone and maybe not seeing the patient, you know, there's that risk of I'm consulting this doctor, but they're not seeing the patient. And mm-hmm. So they could also kind of, you know, be liable for anything that happens. But their willingness to still do that anyway, because we have to still deliver the care. You know, if I call and say I have a woman that's bleeding and she's 26 weeks, she's not going to make it there. Can you walk me through? Mm-hmm. And they're willing to do that. It's really focusing on the patient. And so I think telehealth has really expanded, especially since COVID. We also do a lot of remote patient monitoring. So women that live an hour and a half away, we have them, you know, you can check your blood pressure at home and we can just do a video visit and you can show me, you know, or we can, you know, we're working on maybe sending them home with a Doppler or doing things remotely so it doesn't inconvenience them. And it also improves, you know, efficiency for us because then we can see a little bit more patients in the clinic. And then also incorporating AI. So we are using digital scribes now where we have them record the conversation, you know, they're HIPAA compliant. And then when we leave the visit, the note is done. And so I can just focus on the patient. I can look them in their eye. I'm not looking at the computer and then looking back at them. And it makes it more personable. And it really has increased at least my press gain comments because I have more time to spend with them. And I think that's something that across the board will help even with burnout. Like I don't have to come home and tell my 6 children, wait a minute, I have 20 notes I still have to finish. I'm not coming to your basketball game. That will significantly decrease burnout. So, yeah, I think digital, AI, all of that is the way of the future, especially in healthcare.
And what has been the patient response to things like telehealth, remote patient monitoring? What's been your experience with how they're seeing it?
Well, you know, it really affects the older patients who are not are like housebound or in the nursing home or Just, you know, they don't like to come out of the house, especially in Iowa, because, I mean, 9 months of the year, it's cold and snowy. And I moved here from Hawaii, so, you know, I get it. I wouldn't want to leave if there was snow on the ground. It really helps to still look to have our eyes on them and still be able to deliver the care, because everything, medications can be sent electronically. Labs can be faxed to a local area. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't all have to be, you have to come here and we inconvenience you to convenience us. So it also makes it the patient, and it makes them more compliant with their follow-up visits as well.
Well, I want to continue pulling on this thread here about technology in the rural health space. Dr. Schreiner, we know that technology is ever advancing and evolving over time. How do you see it impacting rural health access, quality of care, given the realities and potential issues with things like broadband?
Yeah, first of all, I don't ever want to follow Dr. Milner again, because you were spot on all of the things that you mentioned. And Erica, I think the technology is—it is so exciting about what we can do going forward, and it is getting better. And the amount of people in our rural communities that do have access to Wi-Fi is improving, because very important programs, and just some technology that is better now than it was before. One of the things that we have found is if we can do a humanistic handoff of technology, then the people do so much better. Mm-hmm. If we can have a home care nurse in the home for the first time that they do that virtual visit, then the next series of visits go better. So if we can still have that person there that has that empathy and that ability to get, show them where to click. You know, I remember buying my dad an iPad, and I was talking to him over the phone. He's 86, how to set it up. And he told me, my iPad doesn't have that button. Well, he's how do you do that if you're not in person, where you can help him to find just where that button is? So can we take technology? Can we take AI? Can we bring these things together and not lose that human touch that goes along with it?
Yeah, great point, because it can be very intimidating, especially for, you know, different populations that just don't have the familiarity with new technology or technology at all. And so having that what was it, Dave, the humanistic touch. I think that's a really, really great point. And Dr. Knudsen, there's a lot of government initiatives around technology, mm-hmm. rules of the road that guide the use of technology in healthcare settings. How do you see federal government working in tandem with technology to create better health outcomes?
You know, I had a chance to also look at a program that was using home health nurses, and this particular entity only had one nurse that was certified in wound care. And they were testing an app so that the home health nurses would go out and then use that app and provide the information to that wound care nurse that was at the central location. And so she was able to touch so many more patients because of her ability to consult with that particular app than what they would be able to meet in terms of addressing the needs of those who needed wound care. I mean, clearly she would go when there were needs that she absolutely had to address. But to provide some of that ongoing consultation, I think we will see a lot more interest in looking at how we can extend the workforce using technology to be more efficient and also to maintain that human touch. We just can't underestimate how important it is to have that human connection. We're never going to send robots out to do all the work that needs to be done, but we can do things smarter and be able to use the resources and technology there, as we have in telehealth, to be able to extend our workforce and also make it patient-centered and better for the patient.
And when I heard that, that reminded me of a story that one of our family medicine physicians told me. He said, just allow me to operate at the top of my license. Mm-hmm. Let me do things all day long that only I can do. Let me make the cognitive decisions that I'm the only one in the building that can make. You know, doctor, you've got to be in that situation so many times that make me do this documentation that someone else could do. What are the things someone else can take off my plate so you can make that basketball game? That's how we keep people in our rural communities. Allow them to operate after their license, whether they're a physician or a nurse or a plumber.
But I will also say, specifically for me, how it affects telehealth is CMS is changing the reimbursement on that. And I really feel like that should still be at the forefront. Like the reimbursement shouldn't decrease in those instances, especially in rural areas, it should be beneficial, you know, because it's preventative. It can be preventative too. And so that's something that happens. That's a policy, a federal policy, you know, CMS, Medicare, all of that. That's something that I hope doesn't change, but that's something that we should keep out a lookout for coming in 2025.
And if I may add to that, I think one of the opportunities we have in rural health is to really ensure that people understand the issue of fixed costs. Because we have fixed costs in an ED, whether or not people are using it or not, whether we're trying to have potentially avoidable utilization go down, we have a fixed cost for doing business, if you will, in healthcare. And so one of the concerns that we hear a lot from providers is exactly what Dr. Milner said. The cost of having staff provide that care, be it, you know, physicians or APPs or whomever, those are fixed costs. And having lower reimbursement is not going to address the fixed costs that are needed to support those critical providers that are needed to provide those services.
And competition is certainly a part of that as well. 4 years ago, we did not have urgent care in Dixon, Illinois. By May of 2025, we'll have 4 urgent care centers in town.
Wow. So a lot of, you know, concurrent trends happening, right? Mm-hmm. We see reimbursement kind of as this persistent challenge, paired with volume, you know, issues in rural areas. And also this new players to compete with also play a role here. And this possibility for technology to aid clinicians and organizations. Maybe not, we certainly don't want them to replace the human touch, but if there's opportunities to have them help, there's some, I think, some excitement around that. Mm-hmm. And to your earlier point, Dr. Milner, around, you know, technology can potentially play a role for patient care, but also for providers themselves and being able to support them in clinical decision-making and providing the best care for their patients. I think it's very clear from our conversation that rural communities are feeling the brunt of certain issues in the healthcare system more broadly, but they're not the only ones that are experiencing challenges. Dr. Knudsen, how can the systemic challenges that come up in rural healthcare serve as a model to support other underserved communities?
Well, I believe rural providers in particular are incubators of innovation. If you want to test a model or test a new way of delivering care, rural providers are very nimble. I have not seen larger systems being able to implement change at the speed at which rural providers can do so. So I think that is one strength, an asset, if you will, that rural America has over other providers that really should be leveraged, because I think if we can, rural people are very creative. They know how to make it work. And you know what else? They also will tell you right away when something doesn't work. And I think it's really important for us to look at what works as well as lessons learned from what doesn't, so that we are investing in the future for the innovations that will continue to move us forward in providing the kind of care that improves health and well-being of rural residents. And I am very excited about the future. In fact, I just participated in the Future of Rural Health Summit. It was a gathering of 40 different people from across the country for 2 days to identify opportunities and strategies to continue to move rural health forward. And we'll be sharing those strategies throughout the next year. So I think there's just a tremendous amount of energy and optimism about rural, and that we in rural America should be the leaders for innovation.
That's really exciting. And it just goes to underscore how important it is to have rural voices at the table and to be representing their communities and the unique circumstances that their communities are facing. I'm wondering, Dr. Schreiner, and also want to hear from you, Dr. Milner, about, you know, suggestions for decision makers in terms of how to engage with local communities and include those rural perspectives in policymaking and program implementation.
Yeah, first of all, incubators of innovation, that might be a billboard in Dixon next month. I love it. Erica, one of the things that I think is so important is when we look at rural communities and that out-migration of our young people, how do we get in that? And what our experience has been is, let's bring people home. Let's give them opportunities mm-hmm. to in their hometown. We started a program here where we have undergraduate students that are interested in healthcare that spend the summer with us. They spend 8 weeks with us over the summer. We've been doing that for many years, and it's so much fun to go back and see the number of people that are still in healthcare, either on a leadership side or on the clinical side. We have a family medicine residency program in cooperation with the University of Illinois. So, Doctor, I was so excited to hear you're exploring that with Iowa. We recently had our 20th anniversary of that program, and we have two residents every year. Out of those 20 years, we have 10 physicians that are still on our medical staff. So think about that for just a second. That's recruitment and retention. We had a dinner the other night, a holiday celebration, and we employ about 60 physicians. I was looking around that room, and I was thinking how many people were KSB Hospital was either their first job or their second job out of residency. And so many other people, when we recruited them, they told me, my plan is to stay 2 or 3 years. And they're celebrating their 10th and their 15th and their 25th anniversary. So there are reasons to live in rural. And it's personal. It's that ability to serve people that that are interested in the same things we're interested in. And it's really an outstanding opportunity. And some of those carry over to our urban colleagues as well. The same things can be true.
That's great. Dr. Milner, how do you see opportunities for amplifying the rural voice?
We're one of the largest organizations in our community. So we, you know, work directly with the high school. We work directly with our, we have an AIA college here that we provide the sports medicine care for. And so, again, we have the undergraduates come and shadow us. And we also always have medical students in every department. So I think that gives local exposure. And I know the state of Iowa also has a program. If you come back and work here for 5 years from the state of Iowa, they will forgive all your loans. So that in and of itself is a reason to come back, I think. I'm a transplant to the state of Iowa, but Iowans are very loyal to their football, to their colleges, and some people don't want to leave. They just have to leave. Mm-hmm. And also partnering with other, hospitals that are similar. I attended a rural OB innovation summit in Texas with our CEO and our CFO, and we just learned about all these other hospitals just like us that are doing well like us and things that we can do to implement. And they also learn things that they can do that we are implementing. And so I think that, that should always be at the basis of every policy, is having people that work in these areas contribute to that discussion as well.
Great. Well, Dr. Knudsen, you mentioned being optimistic about the future. And so I'd like to conclude by going around the horn to talk about what gives each of you hope about the future in rural communities, kind of what triumphs, big or small, signify a path towards success. So Dr. Schreiner, why don't we start with you? What makes you hopeful?
The thing that makes me hopeful, Erica, is walking out of my office and getting out and seeing the people that are taking care of our patients and their families. Their heart is in the right place. They are so dedicated to the work that they do. All age groups have a tremendous dedication to doing the right thing and understanding that the care that we provide here is as good as it's provided anywhere in the world, as long as we do the things that we should be doing. But the optimism for me is the people.
That's terrific. Dr. Milner?
Same, but also having great leaders, because, the culture is from top down. Mm-hmm. And so leaders like Dr. Schreiner and Kevin Durande, my CEO, I moved over an ocean to come here because he just compelled me so much. I believed in the culture and the vision and their 10-year, recruitment plan. I just believed in it because it was about being a servant leader to the people. And so also, like, every time I deliver a baby, and I deliver a lot of babies by a mother that has less socioeconomic status, less education, maybe addicted to substances, but then delivering a baby and watching her transform and helping her transform her life so that she can raise that child gives me hope.
Wow. And Dr. Knudsen?
I do a lot of presentations, and people often ask me why rural health. And I remind them that, as you started, not only 1 in 5 Americans live in rural communities, but it's where your food, most of your water, a lot of your energy, and your recreation stems from. And we also have a disproportionate number of people in rural communities who are either currently serving in the military or have previously served in the military, as we have on today's call. And I just remind everybody, a strong, healthy, and vibrant rural America is a strong, healthy, and vibrant America. We are foundational to everybody's success, and we can only continue if we have the healthcare providers in our rural communities that are there to serve our rural residents and ensure that we have the economic viability that we need to keep those engines moving forward. It's always about moving forward.
And what a great place to land to end our conversation today. I mean, we've heard such great themes and all of your comments about being nimble, being creative, doing a lot with a little. And really, at the end of the day, it's about connection, it's about relationships, and it's about the people. And we're just a pleasure to have this group of people to join us today. Dr. Milner, Dr. Schreiner, Dr. Knudsen, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to hear from you. You have such storied expertise in rural health, and I'm sure our listeners have gained a lot from this conversation and learned a great deal from you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In other episodes in this series, we'll dive deeper into collaboration efforts and innovative approaches to improve rural health. For future episodes and to learn how KPMG is exploring other critical topics in healthcare and public health, as well as how we can partner with federal agencies, please go to visit.kpmg.us/framinghealthfuture to listen to this installment and more.